This is the Northwoods American Indian Experience, exploring the evolving experience of the Chippewa people in Minnesota. This series is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. The moderator for today's discussion of the historic experience is Bruce Baird of South Dakota Public Television. Our resource people are Red Lake Tribal Historian Tom Kane, University of Minnesota American Indian Studies Chairman Dr. David Bolio, and Bemidji State University professors Dr. Dolores Norman History and anthropologist Alan Brew, who began the discussion.
The original cultures, the pre-contact cultures, were primarily hunting and gathering peoples that lived in small bands that in the Upper Great Lakes area concentrated on a lake, riverine, forest environment, depending primarily on fishing, particularly some of the whitefish fisheries on the eastern end of Lake Superior, and on the hunting of woodland animals, primarily, again, river type things like beaver. There was some hunting of moose. Further west, of course, people would travel on to places like the Red River Valley and hunt bison and then return for most of the year to the woodland area. A difficult problem in talking about Minnesota in the prehistoric time is that there is no continuity from prehistoric into the historic period. The prehistoric inhabitants of this area were primarily Dakota or Siouan peoples, at least as far as archaeologists can determine that, and the Ojibwa people were living in the eastern end of Lake Superior and were related to a large group of Algonquian speakers, primarily hunters and gatherers, who occupied virtually the entire northeastern portion of the continent. And it was these people who were very familiar with the lakes and rivers of the area who were contacted primarily by French traders and who participated very enthusiastically in the fur trade. And the Ojibwa expansion into Minnesota can be related fairly directly to their participation in the fur trade.
Dr. Allen, as a historian, there are some theories as to where the original people came from. The land bridge theory is the one that's being accepted basically by historians. And I'd like you to address the land base, the land bridge theory. And then I'm going to talk to Tom Kane after that about some of the objections that he's running into with the elderly people in terms of where Indian people came from. So I want to get first a historical perspective as to what historians agree happened. And I want to talk to Tom as a cultural person and see what cultural people think.
Well, as you suggested, the Bering Strait theory is the most plausible theory as far as the movement of peoples to the American continent. And they probably did cross a land bridge when the Bering Strait was at a very, very narrow type of land construction. And then they got into the North American continent, and in successive migrations, this took many, many years, they filled the villages and plains of North and South America until there were few spots in the hemisphere that were not inhabited. And as time passed, a great diversity of human societies developed in what was to become the United States of America. And these new arrivals then adapted to the various regions in the United States, so they got accustomed to the type of life situation there was in the humid woodlands of the East, in the grasslands of Mid-America, in the arid mesas of the Southwest, where for some unexplainable reason the population grew to the greatest extent, and in the fishing coasts of the Pacific Northwest and the Great Lakes region that we live in here, the drainage system of the Mississippi, the St. Lawrence River, and the Hudson Bay region. And by the time the first Europeans arrived, these peoples then had had an experience of several thousand years, and they had developed several hundred distinct languages and a variety of social structures. So the life experience of these peoples was at a very high standard. They had a sophisticated type of societal experience when the Europeans met them and depended on them for survival.
Now I would ask both an anthropologist and a historian. Some information that I have read recently identifies the Indian races as possibly being one of three groups of people or a combination of. One, a Mongolian tribal people, northern Tibet, Mongol, or from the Arno-Japanese Islands, or Caucasians from as far away as the Ural Mountains, who eventually came over on the land bridge. If any one of those are true, or a combination of any of them are true, then why do all full-blood Indians from the tip of Alaska to the tip of South America have black hair, brown skin, and brown eyes?
The particular theory I think you're addressing was developed in the 50s by at a conference in Michigan by some physical anthropologists, including Kuhn, Garn, and Birdsall. Birdsall, in particular, feels that there was an early population located somewhere in Eastern Asia. Anthropologists don't deal with precision, as you probably know, that this population gave rise to, eventually, the American Indians, probably with some addition of Mongoloid traits, to the Ainu in Japan, and to the Maurarian peoples of Australia. The reason for the similarities in coloring in the Americas is generally believed to be related to the fact that the original peopling of the continent was probably by a very small population moving across the Bering Strait land bridge. The term land bridge, by the way, is an improper way to think of it. The Bering Strait area at this time was 800 to 1,000 miles wide and was on its southern margins an extremely lush hunting area because it was warmed by the Japanese current while the rest of the area was affected by glaciations. The filtering through Alaska, for instance, would have acted as a sort of as a strainer in terms of its the effect on the genetics of the people. It should be pointed out, by the way, that while there are very definite similarities in coloring, there are considerable physical differences among the people of this hemisphere. California Indians, for instance, particularly those on the islands, were frequently very heavily bearded, and that is one of the characteristics that has been used to support the relationship to the Ainu people of Japan. So while there are considerable similarities, there are also a great number of physical differences, particularly in stature, body build, and to some extent facial form.
From a scientific point of view, in the mid-50s, they developed the discovery of magnetic lines in the floors of the oceans, leading to the theory of plate tectonics. At one time, there was only one landmass. I think the name they give it to it is Pangaea, in which all life began. And Dr. Leakey's work in Eastern Africa, you find the same fauna, the same animals in certain parts of South America as you do in Africa. You find certain animals that don't occur anywhere else, as the land mass split into the various plates. Is there anything wrong with the theory that these people were on these plates as these plates began to split and were not part of a land bridge theory?
Basically, the single mass theory, and particularly the Gondwanaland theory, which was that Australia, the Indian subcontinent, Africa, and South America were at one time all connected, that theory relates to a time relatively early in the Earth's history, and the animals that occur in both areas are very primitive animals. They're sort of halfway between amphibians and reptiles. So the basic problem there is that we're looking at a period of many hundreds of millions of years ago. What the African research of Dr. Leakey has shown is that the basic primate stock, the monkeys, the apes, and so on, evolved into human beings in the old world. there is a nice evolutionary sequence of the primates leading up to man in the old world. In the new world, that particular sequence is lacking. The only other primates in the new world besides humans were the new world, or are the new world monkeys, who are very different from the monkeys of Africa in many characteristics. So it is generally believed by anthropologists that the earliest men that reached the New World, and anthropologists use the term generically, were modern Homo sapiens sapiens, and the best evidence we have is that they evolved in the Old World, probably somewhere in the Mediterranean basin.
So now we're done historically.
It is important, though, to talk about where Indian sovereignty originates.
Yes.
Where it comes from. It does not come delegated by anybody else. It is indigenous to Indian people.
It's a continuum.
And it depends, of course, on what tribe or what culture you are, how you define that. But by and large, sovereignty comes from God and the messengers who gave people government, laws, and morals.
Right.
And it comes from that source, and or from the people themselves. Is not delegated to Indian people by the federal government or by any other level of government.
But that sovereignty has, though, been recognized by the federal government in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
After the Revolutionary War, for instance, when the federal government had to deal from a position of helplessness, they were not a powerful nation. They had to have the help of the people west of their boundaries. And negotiations were done in sense of sovereign nations, nations working together. So that historically there is some significance for the federal government recognizing sovereignty as an entity for Indian people.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask David, you know, I agree with you that we've spent too much time on the 19th century, for instance. We've got to really get out of that type of thing and get up to today. And the purpose of this whole panel is to take a look at that erosion of sovereignty and explain the semi-sovereign state that Indians are experiencing right now, the type of state that you described. However, how do you feel about books that completely ignore, you know, thousands of years of life experience on this continent that just start out, you know, with the Europeans in contact? Somehow or other, it's a very difficult thing to do, and you have to deal with conjecture. We just don't have the kind of things that we're comfortable with in history, documentation. But you can't really ignore thousands of years of life experience.
Okay, that's right. But the issue is, of course, that what you're suggesting is that American history ignores that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I suggest that that's indeed its function, because it's American history. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, it's written. The American history precedes two periods. One is historic, and the other is prehistoric, before history, you see. In the life memory of Indian community is indeed the entire history, you know, and it doesn't ignore that experience at all, and it's held within the community, and there are really two histories. They cannot be combined. There are two independent experiences, and there are two different ways of thinking of the world and of viewing things and so forth, and I do not perceive it possible, although many of us attempt to do so, to integrate those two experiences and suggest that we have the truth. It can't be done.
I agree with that. I think it is necessary to recognize, however, that the bottom line in this is that there is an interface between these two histories, and this is basic to the issue of sovereignty. In a recent lands claim case in Massachusetts, for instance, the plaintiff, I believe the town was McAfee, the plaintiff,
Mashpee,
okay. The plaintiff was required by the judge to demonstrate that they had been a tribe in 1790, that they had been a tribe in 1850, and that they were a tribe again at the time they were pursuing the case. And the jury found that they were not a tribe in 1850 and therefore found against them. So we have to look at the history. We have to look at the community, as you point out. But that community is going to be defined for legal purposes by the American court system. And at the moment, there's no way around that particular point.
Let's look at a question of the definition of sovereignty in a sense. I said mine was the ability to make mistakes. you agree, or is there some other longer definition or more involved definition that you'd like?
I would hate to think that we're fighting for the right to make mistakes. You know.
Yeah, I know.
I know. I think there are plenty of people who can make good decisions. You know.
Right.
You know, so forth. I know what you're trying to say. It just comes out.
It just comes out that way.
Comes out negative. You know, it comes out bad. But it's sort of like what Felix Cohen said in his article on Indian self-government. He said the self-government is not the ability of people or the ability of the wisest to govern or those closest to the throne or those closest to God to govern. It's the government of the people. And people make mistakes, you know, okay, fine. But it's recognizing that ability of those who are affected by decisions to control the actions in their lives or control what happens in their lives. And I think that the thing that's really interesting about it, about that particular article, is the thing, it's a sort of a parody he talks about Diogenes and Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great, who had conquered all of the known civilized world, I use that word in quotes, civilized world, but had conquered all of the world, rich man, powerful man, comes to Diogenes, who was a poor, wise man, making his home in a bathtub, and he's impressed by the man's wisdom, and he says, "What can I do for you? What can I give you?" And the man sat back, and he says, "Well, you're standing in my sunlight. Get out of the way." That's all he wanted. And at times, that's what it's really about. There's very little that people can do to give Indian people self-government, to give them.
Diogenes, wasn't he the man that carried a lantern around looking for an honest man or something like that? Yeah, carry that around looking for an honest man.
You know, the thing that he was trying to say is that all the government at times has to do to enable sovereignty and self-government is to stand back, to stand out of the way, allow people to take care of things for themselves, which is an interesting.
Does it then stem from an individual sovereignty, a God-given right, if that's what you want to call it, of an individual to make up his own mind, do his own thing, or her own thing, that in turn expanding into a community, regardless of its size, to be able to develop, expand, and do its own thing?
No, I don't perceive that it originates from the individual, because there would be individuals who would not like maybe the exercise of tribal jurisdiction upon themselves, even if they were members, you know, who wanted to do something else, who would live out of the community. There are cases where, say, a man wanted to establish a Christian church in a Pueblo community, and he was denied that ability to do so. And he went to court and said, "Well, no, you can't do nothing about it. You know, that's what these people in this community decide who should be. That's jurisdiction, that's sovereignty.
That's where it's all at." How does it reflect to, in terms of Indians today, sovereignty?
The first time, what a... a preliminary. Listen to these two talk. Remind me of Professor Boas, Dr. Benedict, Ruth Landis. I've worked with Landis, Margaret Mead, of course. And I don't know, it brings you back. Now, in 1947, I wrote into the Commission of Indian Affairs. We've heard of sovereignty. We asked if we could get a seat in the United Nations on that basis. I didn't even get an answer. I did not get an answer at all. See, but we were entitled to have a seat if we were considered as part of the sovereignty. But I did not get an answer. Sit with the United Nations in their discussions with other nations.
Where do you think that development came from? To be stripping down a quote-unquote a sovereign, independent nation to what Indian tribes are today?
I think it comes from a fundamental conflict of interest within the federal government.
I'll say administrations did that. BIA, mostly, through the Department of the Interior. That's stripping them down to their own level, you might say, to bring them down to what they are as foreigners, and to create all the genocide they could against the people. Customs, ways, and living, and their language, even in their religion. Now, religion plays a very important part in the Indian belief of what's happened in the past. The first that I've heard was when the Spirit created the earth, he took different lumps of mud. He put them in different territories. He says, this is where you're going to be. He took some black mud. This is where you're going to be. He took some red mud. This is where you go. That's the Indian. He said, took some white mud. This is where your territory is going to be. So on and on, they discuss that, see. That's really prehistory. That, as the Indian says it, not as the anthropologist. I work with anthropologists all the way from Columbia to UCLA for several years as an interpreter, and I've learned a lot doing that. But I don't know. It's pretty hard to come to a conclusion, definitely. We're always at a dead end. Anthropologists specialize in a certain field, you know, when they go out and write their, get their dissertation through. And they have their own opinion. Sometimes it's a lack of poor interpretation on the part of the interpreter that they get their misinformation. A lot of that is just not it, that's all. It's the way I found out working with these anthropologists. And the fact that I could interpret was why I was on demand all the time by the anthropologist. Well, go to Tom Paine, that's all I should tell at the office.
Why was it necessary to strip Indians of all sovereignty? You mentioned a conflict of interest. What conflicts of interest were there? Why was it necessary to strip them of everything?
For their own benefit, of course.
True.
That's at least the way it was rationalized. It wasn't,
that's
of course,
right,
for Indians' benefit.
Not for Indians' benefit, for the federal government.
Right.
There's
sure.
always a fundamental conflict, I think, between the federal government's trust responsibility in Indian affairs and the responsibility of the federal government regarding the public welfare, quote unquote, mm-hmm. whatever that is defined at is any moment.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever the public welfare begins to, at least perceived by those who administer Indian affairs, outweighs the, mm-hmm. The rights of the federal government to protect Indian interest, you see Indian lands lost, Indian resources lost, and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. And that's why it's so vital an issue today with the energy crush. Mm-hmm. And with vast coal deposits on Indian lands, timber, uranium, so on and so forth, the conflict of interest is painfully obvious. You know, it's there. And you can see developing backlash coming out of states and so on and so forth where Indians have begun to become very aggressive regarding their jurisdiction. But there has been a movement, and I think the federal government first got into it. If you look at the early statutes, most of the Indian laws were not Indian laws at all. They were laws of the federal government to control the actions of its own citizens relative to Indians. They were restrictive on non-Indians. One could not trespass into Indian territory. You had to get a license to do this, to do that, to interact here or there. So they were restrictive against U.S. own members. It was perceived that the government could not make laws affecting Indian people. And that changes. And it changes over time, particularly during that period from the Marshall decisions on through to the Curtis Act, when the government, when the act of Congress, when the legislative unit of the federal government abolished, it said, we abolish these governments, five civilized tribes, you know, which suggests quite a different change in the government's perception of its powers and abilities relative to Indian tribes. Also the 1871 thing, an appropriation act of Congress, said that we will no longer make treaties with Indians. You know, 1871 just passed a law and said so.
Called them agreements afterwards.
They called them agreements afterwards.
Yeah.
Whereas before, one would negotiate, at least on paper, negotiate a treaty, which would have to be ratified in Congress, then would have to get an appropriation out of the House. Now you had a law. After 1871, a law passed in Congress telling what the policy would be. Okay. Then a local law, let's say, for example, a Lapland Act. Dawes Act passed 1887. In Minnesota, you have the Nelson Act, 1889. Then you have the United States Chippewa Commission running all over Minnesota to negotiate agreements that are sort of after the fact. Although at Red Lake, they held out, and they did not allot their lands there. So at least they did exercise some ability to counteract congressional power at that time. So the realities of it, I guess, are
more
somewhat
so
different
now than ever. Now,
mm-hmm. But do you think, so, also in an attempt to answer the question why dominance and white superiority was something that the French and the English and the Dutch and everybody who came across the Atlantic brought with them, and the goal was to dominate and become the superior race. You know, they had that idea. It was just a part of their life system.
But is it really that? Because the people that came here were not the elite of Europe.
Mm-hmm. They were racist. You know,
there were many states that are now states, Georgia, North mm-hmm. Carolina, Florida, that were settled by convicts and criminals.
But
who
they
were shipped
racist.
Out of Europe to do these things.
And convicts and criminals can be racist.
Yeah. Would it be a sense of frustration on the parts of mm-hmm. those people that came instead, having themselves been suppressed, finding mm-hmm. someone else that they can suppress,
probably
and suppress so. Them?
But I was going to get at the point that throughout the course of the process, whereby, first of all, the European peoples recognized the right of occupancy and insisted upon treaties, on agreements, on negotiations. And do you think that it was because negotiating was cheaper than fighting? It was an easier way to get about this dominance type of thing?
Well, it depends on what period you're into. Mm-hmm. Now, in the discovery period, quote-unquote, when the Europeans developed what was called the doctrine of discovery, in effect, to the extent that Europeans kept their word on this doctrine of discovery, they limited Indian external sovereignty. For example, if Europeans, you know, say that we claim this area, the French claim this, the Spanish claim that, and among ourselves, we will agree that no other European party will, except the ones who claim it, will trade with these people, no other European party will buy the land from these people, or no other European party will conquer it. So that if they kept their agreements, which they didn't, but on paper you could see how any particular tribe living in an area would be somewhat limited from negotiating with who it
wanted to,
and so on and so forth. It didn't mean that they lost their sovereignty. It existed, but their ability to exercise it was limited.
And that's I think, where we're going, or where it has come from, is the ability to exercise sovereignty.
That's
may
right.
be the major question, rather than the total loss or the ability to exercise it has never been lost.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Let's get a little background on this. Indians lived in groups at one time. They traveled from place to place. Economic situation created that, to the sugar bush, to the mm-hmm. fishing place, to the wintering place where there's wood and rabbits and food. Most of those migrations were economic. They were driven economically. Well, they had groups called their own relations, and also that's where your totem business started. And they had their leaders until the United States government started getting in contact with the different tribes. And they went on and made agreements and treaties with them, but they selected their old chief, the one that would listen to them. They just appointed the chief. It wasn't a regular chief. Mm. Any chief will tell you that. Years back, they were appointed by the United States government as a yes man for their negotiations.
And they were often paid quite handsomely for
right,
the
right, right, every sheriff. Uh-huh.
We look at today's day and age, really there are only two kinds of reservations, open reservations and closed reservations. And the only closed reservation in this whole country is at Red Lake.
Right.
That wasn't allotted. All the other reservations in this country have been allotted at one point or another through various homestead acts and whatever. The relationship that Red Lake has now in refusing the Nelson Act and saying we will not allot
right.
and remaining closed.
Red Lake was a reservation before the state became a sovereign. So naturally the sovereignty runs into that. Any lawyer can tell you that.
And this would be
that's done research on that.
This would be an exercise in using the powers of sovereignty and saying no.
Red Lake's land status is unique among all almost Indian lands because it has never ceded its title to either the United States or the state or anything. It
they
has
compromised,
never
that's all.
Original title.
Given some land, ceded some land to them, and that was a compromise.
In our next program, we will continue our discussion of the historic experience with Dr. David Bolio of the University of Minnesota, Tom Kane, tribal historian from Red Lake, Bemidji State University professors Dr. Dolores Norman and Alan Brew, and moderator Bruce Baird. This is the Northwoods American Indian Experience.